Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Deep Dive with me, Stephen. Thanks so much for your company. I know we've been talking about many issues over the course of the last few weeks, and we thank you all for your input and your feedback. Today, we'll be talking about a case that has gripped the headlines for the past few years. In February 2020, 4-year-old Megan died after being abused for more than a year by her mother and her mother's boyfriend. Megan's death came about 11 months after her preschool teacher first noticed multiple bruises on her and alerted the school and community workers. According to court documents, her body was burned in a metal barrel and the remains were never found. So how did this happen? How did Megan slip through the cracks? A review panel last week found multiple lapses and shortcomings among agencies that handled her case, including a lack of clear understanding and communication among the agencies. Now, the panel also made several recommendations to close the gaps in our child protection system and also try and prevent such tragedies from happening again. So we're going to dive into this issue today. And joining me, I have Cindy Ng Tay, Director of Melrose Home at Children's Aid Society.
Hi, this is Cindy.
Dr. Hana Al-Haddad, a child and family specialist and an advisor of research and advocacy at everychild.sg.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
Well, ladies, thank you for coming in. Let's talk about the review panel findings, because they showed that it wasn't just one slip-up. In fact, there were a series of missteps from various organizations along the way. What do you guys make of these findings? Cindy, you want to go first?
I think the first thing that is important to note is that we welcome the findings of the independent review, and it's a very bold step to take given the first press release, which suggests that actually that we might not have gotten the full picture of what has happened. So the independent review panel, the fact that it's been conducted underscores how important it is for such reviews to become a permanent stay whenever there is a child fatality, so we could actually have a good look at what actually happened and commit ourselves time and again to make the system even better for the children that we are serving and we are trying to protect. So that has been a relief in many ways that we have this panel to look at the results and look at the evidence, and now we have some ideas as to how to close some of the gaps.
But why only now, right? So we're going to talk about that in a little bit. Hana, what about you?
When the review panel report came out, again, you know, I feel the chills again, because it's, you know, when you're in the space and you work with children, especially vulnerable children, every case like this just eats at you. And I'm just going to be candid and say that it took an independent panel to have us to really start looking, review, reflect, and confront the gaps in the system. It didn't need to be that way.
Okay.
Right? And that's why we are calling, I mean, every child is calling for child well-being to be a national priority. And for that, I also believe that this independent review has to be institutionalized. It needs to continue. It can't be reactive and wait for another child's life to be lost.
This is a real tragedy. When we look through the review and the report, I mean, the lapses, many of them were within the control of different people along the way, right? I mean, the incident report to EGDA did not include Megan's mother's suspected drug abuse. There were also other issues. Well, is it difficult to ensure that these lapses don't occur? Because, like, when the care plan falls through, is it hard for a social worker to get it back in place, to get it running? I mean, what are some of the challenges there?
Yeah, and I think in terms of child abuse as an issue to deal with in itself is very complex. And because it is very dynamic. I mean, what I reflect upon the various gaps that the report had highlighted, if you look at each time frame, like if you freeze each incident, you can probably find ways that the organization or the professional could have done differently, the frontline staff. So that in itself could be a number of reasons, like maybe just lack of knowledge. It could be lack of capacity or, you know, just the ability of the frontline staff to respond, if we look at it in that time frame, that just freeze that moment. Yeah. But it becomes a problem when you notice that it is the same problem, but it happens across different organizations. Mm-hmm. And it happens across different types of organizations, like from community organizations to statutory bodies, then that actually suggests that it's a much deeper issue. It's not just about compliance to SOPs or to frameworks. So we do have to confront the issue that this may be beyond human error, that perhaps as a society, we do need to take time to reflect, why is it that our frontline staff are all struggling to see the child in the context of his or her risk environment, that you need to take a step back and not see the child linearly. And even if you don't seem to have the full context of the situation, to have that ability or the courage to ask a bit more or to confront or to disagree.
In other words, they sort of had this checklist.
Yeah.
They went through it, they ticked the boxes, but they were not able to look at the bigger picture to realize that even though these boxes have been ticked,
there's still something
else that is amiss and
that's
not
quite
working out.
That's right. Yeah. And of course, then why, right? Why is it that our frontline staff are struggling with this? There could be a number of different issues. So we also can't lay all the burden on the frontline staff and assume that it's about capability building or it's just about capacity. So, which is why in many you know, offline conversations, we as leaders in the sector need to reflect and think about very tangible issues like workload.
Okay.
Like, you know, whether staff and our frontline staff are able to and have the capacity, and whether there is performance pressures, whether there is communication gaps across different groups of people. So those are the very tangible issues that we need to look at beyond overloading our frontline staff with even more capability building or training and frameworks or more checklists upon checklists. Mm-hmm. So those are the areas that actually we do need to challenge ourselves to think about it even more.
And of course, that is very difficult to do because, you know, you're saying basically, do I have the right person for the job?
Yeah.
You know, so that they are
able
to...
Do they exist in the right environment to do the job?
Ah.
Right? Do we have the culture of, say, a reflex, like a kind of like a quick reflex, right? When you sense that something is wrong, do you act on it? Do you notice? Do you challenge?
Yeah.
Do you ask? So for example, even if the childcare teacher, for example, did not provide the full picture, could you ask more, right? Even if you suspect that this is a child discipline case, for example, in the case of the police, right? But the child has been missing for 4 months. Wouldn't you be curious where the child is? So some of this curiosity, professional curiosity and sensitivity to what's going on in the child's life seems to be a little bit dull. Because it appears in different professionals, so that warrants a very deep examine what's going on in our culture, what's going on in our society, that different folks, actually, their own senses are all dull. This is not a witch hunt.
Yeah.
We cannot go straight to the professionals and go, okay, so this professional has been terminated, this other one has a financial penalty to this act, or that this organization is going to do whatever. Yeah. What is going on in our culture?
Is this reflective of a bigger culture within the circle, within this industry, for example, where they're not willing, there's not much collaboration, I can't pick up the phone and say, hey, I've just had this client and, you know, she's on your file as well, and, you know, to share information. I don't know.
Across the board, that you can see, it's like as if it's this big puzzle, 1,000-piece puzzle, right? Everyone's got different pieces of the puzzle, but you can only see the pieces that is like near you, right? But no one can actually see the whole picture. No one can actually see the whole child or how to put everything together.
Correct.
Right? So there is that, hence that there's the coordination problem, and everyone has...
So they only see one side of the child, or one perspective, one view, one area.
One area of their expertise.
But why is that? I mean,
That's a good question.
That's a good question.
That's a very good question. Like, why is that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and I think that is the part that I sometimes hesitate to comment on a lot because we need to find out what is that.
Okay.
My guess is that it's not so straightforward, that it is not just about capability building. Mm. It's not just about capacity. My guess is that we might need to really examine the pressure on the frontline staff.
Okay.
Because a very highly stressed workforce does not have the capacity to think flexibly or does not have the capacity to think, to integrate more information or to make decisions, to make good decisions. I mean, just think about us in our best performance at work, right?
Yeah,
you perform best not when you're the most stressed usually.
Right.
Adrenaline
right.
gets you somewhere, but not to the best performance.
Yeah. And I think we need to shift this culture. And I think having that independent review, I think we're at an inflection point where we can say now, let's keep that going and have, for example, appoint an independent commissioner for children, right? We need children to have someone to speak out for them. And throughout, it's across sectors, across ministries, right?
Okay.
So that person's job is really to put the child front and center, to look at child safety, well-being, protection, and this is what needs to happen. So that comes with, for example, like public-facing child protection safeguarding policies across all the places or spaces where children go. Right. Or where you interact with children. So in child protection or in teachers or parents, when they don't know what to do, okay, let's ask, there is that voice.
Okay, okay.
Or that speaks, okay, what do I need to do for the best interest of the child?
And they are seeing the full picture of the entire child.
So the commissioner or let's say a coordinating minister.
I want to go back first to, you're talking about pressures on the frontline staff. These are the teachers, the preschool teachers, the teachers on the ground dealing with, you know, 20, 30 kids every day, you know, so many different ones. Are they equipped? Do they know exactly how to react when faced with these situations? Or will they just turn to the SOP and say, okay, 1, 2, 3, I've done my due diligence, I've filed the report.
Yeah.
Let's just leave it as that.
My opinion after looking at the report is that the childcare and the key organization that is fronting Megan's well-being has done multiple things from the point where she has actually left school.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't be, I suppose, appropriate to also say that they didn't follow through. It was beyond the checklist already.
Yeah. So that's also the question, how much further can they take it? Because you feel like my scope is here. Should I be making the police report, for example? That was one of the issues as well, right?
Yep. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So that part about the whether who can make the police report, is a misunderstanding of how legal frameworks work. And, I mean, we all fall into that sometimes where we misunderstand the legal framework. So it is important for us to know, but I think it's not surprising that some of us may misunderstand. Okay, but I think what was problematic was seeing how perhaps other systems respond, where taking the information at face value or not really seeing the child in the context of its environment. So it's very linear. So if you see, for example, seeing that, you have the information about the drug history, for example, at the child protection level. You have information about the drug history. You have information that child is missing. But with that information, the limited response is, please ask the family member to file a police report. Mm. So why? There's a very, very limiting response, of which actually MSF did take responsibility for it in the report, and they accept that this is an area that their staff needs to do better. I will go further to ask, why didn't your staff have that capability? Is it because they are not trained sufficiently? Is it because they are pressed for certain level of, I don't know, performance issues that we are not aware of? So that's that part that then MSF had to look into, you know, to review what's going on for their child protection officers.
Is there a situation where, you know, perhaps the officers are hesitant to make any kind of an official report also, because you're also thinking of the family. If I put it down in black and white, it means you know.
Yeah, sometimes you worry, right?
Sometimes the
fear is real, the worry is real. Like, what if I make a police report and then it makes it worse?
Yeah.
If, let's say, steps are not taken to protect the child adequately, what if me making the police report is going to make it worse for the child?
Yeah. And then the parents find out you, the teacher, made the police report. They come after you. Why did you make a police report? Right?
Yeah. That could be one fear. Although professionally, we are also taught to that this is part of the job.
Yeah.
You know, you have to break bad news to the people that you work with sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, but what you should do and what you end up doing sometimes are two different things.
Yes, exactly. Yes. But there is duty of care. If you knew that there's someone is in danger and in hurt, then there is duty of care to report, or there's duty of care to respond. I would imagine that perhaps family members sometimes don't know. Members of publics may not know and may be more unwilling or not ready to. I think professionals probably we need to take a hard look at what can help our frontline staff be bolder.
I mean, in general, it, because as a bystander, if I hear my next door neighbor fighting, arguing, I would think very hard before I act on it, right?
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. And that's that part where actually beyond the findings of this report, many people have also been reflecting.
Yep.
Like, what do we do when you hear something that may inconvenience you or might cause you some strain in relationships? So what would you be prepared to do? So, the question is also that, did someone spot Megan? You know, did someone see something? Did you hear something? Beyond the profession, the professionals who work with the family, surely somebody must have seen. So did anybody step in? So perhaps actually the findings should also provoke us to think even further, how as a community or as a society, are we responding to other people's well-being being compromised?
Right.
Yeah, because there's a lot in this, in the community where we go,
it's not my problem,
or I don't want to step over boundaries, you know, it's their own family, private family
business.
And
what if it wasn't really abuse, or what if it wasn't what I think it is, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, see, on hindsight, we can say a lot of things and everything's that much clearer. But Hannah, going back to your recommendation of having someone sort of oversee, like a specialist child protection case management, I mean, a commissioner of children or something to that effect, how is that better? Because is it not just another level of bureaucracy? And if the different agencies don't talk to each other, that person won't know anything anyway.
Yeah, so that person's job, I'm writing a job scope now for the commissioner.
Why not?
So that person's job would be to pull these agencies, ministries together, right? That person's job is to have, it's a leadership authority. Right, it is not someone on the ground or in the field. It is ministerial level leadership that looks at specifically children's issues across the board. MOE, MSF, MOH, MCCY, all the different SPF, right? All the different touch points where children are involved or experienced. Right? How do we put the children front and center? For example, they say, oh, there's not enough information, only excessive discipline was put. And I'm like, why wasn't that flagged?
Yeah.
Because we have different language. It's the same words, but the meaning is different across different agencies.
You mean the term excessive discipline?
The term
means
excessive discipline.
How is it different across different agencies?
Why wasn't it flagged as high risk, right?
Okay.
And it's, you should have asked more. But why isn't that enough when you see, the social worker put the report, excessive discipline? Why wasn't that escalated? Why do you need more information? So there needs to be standards and protocols to say, okay, when you see certain things, these are the standards that you need. And that's the job of the commissioner, to make sure to keep all the different ministries accountable, to say that when you see these certain things, this is what you need to do. These are the steps. These are the procedures. These are the protocols.
So you're saying, in a word, for example, if that term excessive discipline had been put in any report, it should have triggered some other alarm bell somewhere at the next level for further investigation.
The most prevalent type of abuse is physical abuse, the World Health Organization has stated that physical abuse causes long-term harm, lasting effects. It causes more harm than whatever the adults think that it might work, right? It causes physical and mental health. And the most important thing is that it has inbuilt risk of escalation to maltreatment and abuse. So that alone could signal the term excessive discipline.
Okay.
Is a trigger factor. It's so a red flag.
It sounds like what you're saying in a way is that right now there isn't a... There's some misalignment between the different agencies, the ministry, the child protection services, where left hand, right hand are not entirely sure of what the other is doing. For example, if there's a police report of child abuse, the social worker may not know about it because if the parents don't say anything about it, you have no right to also access the police records, right? Am I correct to say that?
Yeah. Mm. And also it means different things to different people, and that that triggers different responses. I think in the case of Megan Kensey, that how different groups of professionals may view the injuries or the reports of what Megan had sustained. So then what you're
they
trying
to say...
They
view it differently.
Yeah. Oh, so when I actually physically, visually see the abuse, I may say, oh, it's not that bad. And
or
in my
that,
report...
You know,
I
say that the moment you use the word discipline, whether that minimizes what's going on.
Or the child was just being disciplined versus... Ah, I
and
see.
Excessive discipline. Like, what is excessive discipline, right? So maybe to some of us, it's like caning, one stroke, 10 strokes. No, but someone else
and that
right,
is a challenge because some would argue that in my family, caning is okay. They feel it's okay.
Yeah.
And they feel it's not excessive. Yeah. How do we decide what is right, what is not right? And
So I think the part about how difficult this is also is because some of this, the public discourse of what is considered excessive or not excessive, we have not had a really good, robust discussion publicly about this. So, but what that means also is that sometimes it blurs the line. We then don't really know when it becomes abusive. So of course, if you say a report says excessive punishment versus abuse, it would attract different attention.
Yes.
So, but the onus isn't just on the provider of information to ascertain, you know. So like if the report from the child care center is excessive punishment, excessive discipline, right? As a frontline staff who in this case ACDA, who would of course know what is considered children's rights and what is considered what child's well being. You need to know what exactly a child needs, right, in order to thrive. So I would imagine that frontline staff would also be able to ask. Like when you say excessive discipline, what do you mean?
What do you mean?
Okay.
Yeah.
So the two-way thing for us not to just land on that one report and go, if it's excessive discipline, maybe it's not that serious.
Yeah.
Okay. So in a way, it's not... I mean, okay, this grey area is very hard for us to clearly say what is okay and what is not okay. But you're saying the social worker should have been able to go further, take a step further.
I think both ways. It should be a two-way conversation.
Yeah, because the parent's going to come and say, oh, I was just disciplining her. So the social worker should be prodding further, pushing harder to find out
how
get more clarity on the situation.
And how frequent.
Yes. I think he said that, you know, this was in 2019, 2020. So a lot has changed since then as well. So we must acknowledge that a lot of the interventions right now are in place. How effective it is, I think, waits to be seen. But so we are talking about a situation in 2019 where things are a lot more unclear.
Right. Is it clearer now? If I'm a preschool teacher, I suspect a child is being abused. Is there a hotline I can call? Is there someone I can?
Yes,
there is.
I can press an emergency button.
Yes, you
know
can.
What I mean?
Yeah. Yes, you can. Yeah. Yes, you can. I think the impact of the interventions in the last few years waits to be seen because they were implemented in the last maybe 2 to 3 years.
Okay.
So we do need some time to see what's the effectiveness of it. But I think it's also important to note that back then, it didn't look like there was so much clarity. But what's clear and what's factual is that there probably was an underestimation of the report that was provided at different points. So at different points, there was an underestimation of the impact of the abuse And it goes two ways. It's not just on the person who reports to provide the necessary information. The onus is also on those who receive
who
the information,
information
to be able to piece things together and to be able to ask good questions.
Okay.
So that two-way reflex that we need to develop to be able to notice things quickly and ask the right questions.
Yeah. Because a lot of it is time sensitive.
Yeah, it's just like when you go to a doctor, right? You expect the doctor to properly diagnose you by asking the right questions.
Yeah.
Right? You cannot just expect the patient to come in and say, okay, this is what I think I have.
Okay. And that is a challenge, of course, because I ask you questions, but if the answers you give me are not very detailed, not much information, it's harder for me to diagnose what exactly is going on.
Yeah.
Similarly with the child. How can we all do better? I guess that's one question. So again, this whole bystander thing, I mean, do we need to also change the way we all look at this such that now I know any one of us can press the emergency stop button at any point in time? If I think something is wrong, and how best would we do that without, at the same time, I'm still thinking, I don't want to cry wolf, you know what I mean?
We need to put the children front and center. So I work with, let's say, younger preschool to early primary school students, right, children. And we talk, and I ask them, I said, what is it that you fear most? Mm. What do you think they would say? I ask them, what do you fear most?
Having to eat my vegetables.
Having to eat my vegetables, monsters under the bed, right? But no, they told me we fear getting hit.
Ooh.
Right?
Okay.
And then I asked them, why do you get hit? And they go, I don't know, maybe because I'm a bad person. And they say, I'm a bad person, not I did something bad, right? Our actions, our words shape their self-worth, right? And then I said, so do you think you're going to do it again? What do you think you learned from that? And they pause and they go, don't know, but I know I just have to listen to what my parents or the teacher say so that, I don't get hit anymore, or I just don't get caught.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't teach them the real lesson.
Doing it
right?
out of fear.
But and what it does is they're doing it out of fear. Exactly. It teaches fear, and fear breeds silence.
Yeah.
And that is not what we want in order to protect a child.
And actually, if you had that conversation with a child, then I would be a bit concerned, because it means the environment they are growing up in is one where, you know, fear sort of rules the household. But we do have to wrap up in just a few minutes. But I mean, I just want to come back. We were saying this review has come out. Earlier, you had told me that it's been quite a long time since a review had been done in this industry. I mean,
an independent review.
Why is this independent?
Published.
Why is this a review like this so important?
It is very important to finally see leadership in the sector, in my opinion, to actually step out and say, on behalf of the sector, we let Megan down.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's very important.
Yeah.
Because you cannot move forward until you acknowledge that. So I was very relieved.
Hmm.
And that we pushed forward with this, because I know that it was not easy for the ministry, because you have to confront very difficult questions, right? That many people did not close the gap.
Okay.
Mm.
So this is not just a moment for us to acknowledge that as a system that we have all let Megan
down.
But this is also a time for us, after acknowledging, to then say, okay, so what's next? Right? And the number of professionals who have stepped forward to say, I think I can still do this. Let's recommit to do better. Because there is no more blame game here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been very difficult to watch, but also very heartwarming. It shouldn't take another fatality for us to do this again. But and the truth of the matter is, you cannot prevent every fatality.
Yeah.
It will happen.
Yeah.
But with each, unfortunately, with each time we have let a child down, we must do better. The system mm-hmm. that we mm-hmm. created to support children must become stronger. And one of the biggest take back for this, I mean, I say this a lot, even to directly to ministry themselves, that you need to legislate a child fatality review panel, one that will look at every single child fatality or near fatality case, and make the report public. This accountability will then tell us that this every single child that has died matters, and that their lives matters, and their life, while we didn't manage to protect that child, the experience allow us to have a hard look at where the gaps are and still do better.
It's something that I think will probably haunt us always, right? We let her down. That did not need to happen. And we need to look forward.
We need
to do better. We need to start shifting the culture. We need to start, you know, having people to stop saying, oh, that is not my problem. We're not asking you to go and bang down their door. We're asking you to just check in.
Okay.
Bring a basket of fruits. How are you doing? Check in with the parent. You seem to be having a hard time.
Yeah.
You know, and it's all for whom? For the child, for the better of the child.
Right?
So that we don't have to keep reliving this and going through this heartbreak. You know, every child's life is precious.
I don't think anyone would disagree with you there. And, you know, we've all been really taken by this unfortunate incident. And I think, the whole idea is that we must do better.
We must
do better. You're saying these independent reviews should happen more often, not wait for a tragedy to happen. But, I mean, the world keeps changing, family dynamics change. We need to evolve with the situation as well. And act first, preemptively, and not wait for something to happen.
That's right.
Thank you for coming in, for sharing this with us today, and for all of you who have been watching and joining us as well. This has been a difficult conversation, and we want to hear from you. So if you have thoughts about it too, please do let us know. But otherwise, on that note, this has been another episode of Deep Dive. That's it. We'll see you next week.